Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Positive with the People. In this episode, it's me, Diara, Miles, and Kaya talking about the news that you don't know from the past week, the underreported news with regard to race, justice, and equity. And then I sit down with Pulitzer-nominated reporter Chip Jones to talk about his new book, The Organ Thieves, the shocking story of the first heart transplant in the segregated South. Y'all, I learned about this initially online, reached out, read the book, talked to Chip. Wild, wild, wild. Here we go.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I'm Miles E. Johnson. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Feral Rapture.
I'm Kaya Henderson. You can find me on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
And this is Duray at DIY on Twitter.
This is a special, special edition of Pod Save the People. Woo-woo. Because the Miles E. Johnson, it is your born day. And we appreciate you, your magic, your love, your joy. And we just want to celebrate you today on what is probably, I don't know, your like 27th birthday. So,
okay. If it's your birthday, make some noise.
Okay. Come on, Kaya. If it's your birthday, make some noise. That's like a Baltimore club mix.
Okay.
Wait. Okay. Let me represent for New York. Shine a light on it. Whoa. Shine a light on it. Whoa.
I'm Harlem make shaking. Room. You can't see
it. Let it work.
You can't see it.
Make room.
If it's your birthday, make some noise.
I'm Harlem shaking, if you all can't see it. Thank you all so much. I'm 32 years old. Mm-hmm. And very wild. You didn't have to say the goodness. We didn't need that. We didn't. And I'm so grateful to be sharing my birthday with my aunties and my uncle, no matter how forgetful some of them are.
You know who that was for. And we're coming off of the Oscars, which were last night. Let me just say, I am so tired this morning. One, because the Oscars was 6 hours long and I watched all of it and it was daylight saving. So then we lost an hour. I don't really know how it works. I just know that I woke up this morning very tired. So big wins last night for Everything All at Once, which was amazing. Michelle Yeoh, first Asian woman to win an Oscar, which is the more I watch the Oscars, I'm just like, why are we doing this?
Why?
But it was interesting. The performances, I think the Indian performance, what was it? I think Ra. I probably should get that right before I'm just broadcasting it. But that was amazing. And they won Best Song, which was fabulous. I don't really have a lot. I mean, what were y'all's highlights? I mean, besides Everything All at Once, I was kind of just.
I will say that the idea that this is the second non-white woman ever to win that Oscar is wild.
Atrocious.
Bananas. I mean,
that's nuts. And then, you know, what a sweep for A24, the first studio to win all the major awards in one night. Shout out to A24.
Yeah. I didn't watch it because I was on a plane, but I feel like I saw enough of the recap and, you know, shout out to Michael B. Jordan and Jonathan Majors for...
That was the highlight of the whole Oscars.
Auntie Angela and Rihanna and that D-R-E-S-S, baby. I loved it. I really did. You didn't look at my house? Oh, my gosh.
No, I loved it. I was... in my head thinking about Angela Bassett, and that head nod was about her getting snubbed. Rihanna looked amazing. She actually sounded like really amazing. And then on top of that, like, yeah, it was just really beautiful. It was super long. Mind you, last night I went to go see Patti LaBelle. It started, went to go see Patti LaBelle, got drinks, came back, and it was still on. I was like, this is wildly long. But yeah, I see everybody in internet mourning over over Angela Bassett not winning, and you know, we gotta maybe it's because I had an absentee father or something. I'm like, we gotta get used to the disappointment. We gotta bounce back.
Get out of here.
We gotta bounce back, y'all. We have to expect it.
Can I just pause for 1 second and tell you a cool moment that just happened? I'm in the Amtrak lounge recording because I have to take a train. And this a black woman walks by and she looks at me earlier, doesn't say anything, but she just walks by literally right now. And she goes, I love y'all podcast.
When she comes
back to her seat, I'm going to try and turn the camera. She doesn't know that I'm just sitting here. She doesn't know that we're recording right now because she can't see you all. But she smiled. She was like, I love the podcast. When she comes back, I'm gonna pull her.
Oh, I love that.
It's amazing. And also, so I don't get canceled by the Indian community, it is Natu Natu, the film. And the song is Natu Natu. The blockbusters RRR, Rise, Roar, Revolt. And it was fabulous. And the one thing I will say, and I did say this, I had like a tiny Oscars get together last night. What's fascinating to me, and this is why we need to come together as different communities, marginalized communities seemingly, is that when Rihanna had her time on stage, it was a Black Panther moment. It was blackity, black, black, black. Then when there was kind of a nod to everything at once, and I know David Burns is probably somehow tied to the song, but maybe he's not.
You better say everything, everywhere, all at once.
What? I'm sorry. Auntie, sorry, everybody. It was, you know, Asian performers that the one of the stars from, what is it? Everything, all
everywhere.
I'm never going to get it. It's too long.
And I
love A24 and their client and I adore them, but that title's too long for me, y'all. I need it to be like 2 words less.
Not to give the suggestions after they won the Oscar. I think they're doing pretty okay. You seem to be in the minority. Most people seem to be able to handle it. You're going to tell them it's never going to make it if y'all start that name.
I don't know what's going to happen. But it was interesting because the Asian moment had white participation. The Indian moment had white participation.
Oh,
and I know that that was part of the film. It was explained to me while I was making my own commentary in my house that was part of RRR. Like that was the moment where it was like, cause it talks about colonialism, all of that. But I think it is interesting though, but I don't know. I don't know if y'all noticed that or if that's just me being.
Wait, finish the statement. Well, basically saying there was not white participation when we had the blackity black moment?
That's what I'm saying.
They finished with us. It's over. We wrecked it all last year, huh? Can't come back.
So they said, no, health insurance in America is too flimsy for us to be on stage with y'all. So we're going to go ahead and call this one out. I wonder, and obviously I don't know, I'm Black American, just so this is, I could be totally 100% wrong on this. I wonder how much that matters to other races, like it matters to Black people. Because I think that just because of the Black American history of it, of our history, and specifically Black American, because even sometimes I'll see participation when it, you know, from other African countries, and it just seems to not be a big deal for everything to be Black and for other things to be shut out. So I wonder if that's a us thing too, because of specific things we went through.
Sometimes it's also a little schizophrenic on somebody's part, right? Because like the appropriation of Black culture is rampant, right? And the lack of acknowledgement, I think, is what we're talking about here, right? The lack of participate, like you take our stuff, you consume our stuff, you enjoy our stuff, you whatever, but you can't celebrate with us in the moment when it's our time. And I'm with you, Miles. Let's get accustomed to the disappointment. I don't even expect it anymore, right? But for some people, it's still that white validation is still really important.
I thought DR was actually going somewhere different with this, because one of the critiques I saw on Twitter that I thought was interesting was like, they were like, of course Jamie Lee Curtis wins because you have to center whiteness in a movie about Asian people, that like, how could you get out of a movie that is just about Asian? I mean, it's like all the main characters are Asian. And somebody was like, she wasn't even the best supporting character in her own film. You know what I mean?
But I think that is my point though. Like, I think it is fascinating. Like, can you imagine a white person being on stage during Rihanna's performance that was a nod to Chadwick Boseman and about Black Panther? Like, we would have lost it. but everything everywhere. Or like getting
a Best Supporting Actress award at Wakanda.
Yeah, and it's like everything everywhere. I think I'm getting it all at once. That it was a predominantly it was an Asian film with Jamie Lee Curtis,
but
and
it
the perform and the performance was. I just was like, mm.
But was it okay? So I haven't seen everywhere all at once.
everywhere at once, and
maybe this is my like my Negro Stockholm syndrome, just being a Black American and loving all types of stuff. And I love the Activia commercials, so I don't hate Jamie Lee Curtis. So I love the Activia commercials and all the things she's done.
Right.
That I think that was just so this revolutionary. Let's talk about it. But I'm thinking. From my perspective, there were obviously Asian people in all at once, right? But was it a Asian film? I don't know this. So, like, when I think about, like, the last Asian film, like that was, like, really big, like, this was, like, Crazy Rich Asians, which was about the culture, was about the heritage, it was, like, fantasy, and it was an Asian film, so I feel like if somebody was, like, white in that, and they won in Crazy Rich Asians, it would be so obviously inappropriate, because this is a film about Asian culture, et cetera, et cetera, but... And Wakanda is about Black culture and African culture, so that feels different. But it's all at once really a film that features Asian actors. Am I making sense? Like I don't know how much the Asian, but again, maybe I'm just making excuses because I'm tired of being upset about race. So I'm just trying to like maybe it's not that big of a deal. I'm like, let that Activia woman, she been running from that man her whole life. She been running from that.
Halloween.
I'm glad her get her little gold statue, y'all. I get it, but.
Was that her first Oscar?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Fascinating.
And she's kind of positioned because of the Activia commercials and because we don't appreciate horror movies, she was kind of positioned to never really win an Oscar. So I think that was kind of her end. Like, I get the politics of how come she won, why she won.
God. But hold on. If we can't even start the who is owed an Oscar story without talking about Auntie Angela not giving it for Tina Turner, right? For What's Love Got to Do with It?
Malcolm X.
Yes. Anyway, the Oscars are the Oscars. They're going to be the Oscars. Us expecting them to be anything but the Oscars might be our fault.
Yeah. Okay, well, shout out to April Rain, your legacy. I guess nothing really happened. I guess where April Rain at?
She got us talking about it in a different way. You know, I do think that what I'd say about Jamie Lee Curtis is that I do think it's a film about Asian family. Like that is the star of the movie, and Jamie Lee Curtis is like the antagonist ish. So she has a role to play and she's good at it, but it definitely is like a story. It'd be like Miles if there was like a story that centers a Black family and there's like a white person at the welfare office.
Why I gotta be at the welfare office, right? Let's unpack that.
I'm trying to play on all the tropes. Is that would be what Jamie Lee Curtis's role was. She was like the employee at the... So she was good in the role, but the movie is about the family. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. I guess I'm just thinking, yeah, that makes total sense to me. I just know there's a lot of films that, yeah, I just haven't seen the film and I wasn't sure how much the Asian culture was a part of it. So maybe that was a loophole. But, you know, I'm always down to say white supremacy does it again.
Speaking of which, Silicon Valley Bank failed on Friday and... a ton of people's money was imperiled and somehow or another, everybody's going to get their money back in what was the worst banking failure since the 2008 crisis. I know about this thing firsthand because my little startup's money was in Silicon Valley Bank, y'all.
No. But,
oh, wow. Oh,
for real though. Many entrepreneurs, especially tech entrepreneurs, have their bank accounts and their assets at Silicon Valley Bank. Something like more than 50% of tech startups and healthcare startups were banking with Silicon Valley Bank. So this had huge implications. And today, Monday, is the draw for payroll for most people who pay their staff on the 15th. And so it would have been catastrophic if the government did not step, like literally millions of people would not get paid this week if the government hadn't stepped in to deal with this issue. But y'all, capitalism is a beast. And I don't know what to say about this, but I think there are lots of people who just went through the weekend thinking it was a regular weekend, but there were millions of people this weekend who were literally in crisis. One of my big investors had over $100 million in Silicon Valley Bank, and the FDIC only insures you for $250,000. And so they were looking at all of that money potentially going. Another company that I know just did a raise, a $20 million raise to keep their company going for the next couple of years. And that money would have been gone. Like it is. And these are not like, I mean, these are not your LinkedIns and your Instagrams or your Metas. Like these are small, many of them are small entrepreneurial, innovative startups and stuff. And so, woo child, your president was just on the TV talking about how everybody's going to get their money. And that is capitalism fixing capitalism, I guess.
Yeah, money is so fake. Like I've read the article back and forth, and I technically get it, but also I just don't because I live in a world where what do you mean you gave me $20 million and I don't got it no more?
Yeah, but, that's right. That's right. We all live in that world, Miles. Right. We all live in that world.
I'm like, that's just not gonna happen. And what do you mean that? Yeah, I remember seeing the other thing where there's, I guess, like talk around it being like, how do you say this? Like that there was some kind of like draws, like other people had insight that this was going to happen, and there were like withdrawals that were suspicious that were like that were happening. So I thought that was an interesting perspective too, that there were some people who were in the know, and some people were just left vulnerable.
Yeah, Peter Thiel, who's a big venture capitalist, on Wednesday or Thursday put out a thing saying that all of his companies should withdraw their money from Silicon Valley Bank. And so that created a run on the bank where lots of people are like, give me my money, give me my money, give me my money right now. And the bank could not support it. And so they are investigating whether or not this was manufactured by this, you know, by Peter Thiel's influence in the industry. It's, yeah.
Well, everyone should take a lesson from my best friend, Crochet's grandma, who was known as Grandma's sister, who every Friday in Tipton, Georgia, would go to the bank and have the people give her all her money so she can count it, and then she give back to them.
I know that's right. That's big Aretha Franklin vibes.
Or just be Aretha Franklin and put it in your pocketbook, honey.
I will say the only thing, it was so interesting on Twitter to see the VCs talk about the government's responsibility and da 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 da, while simultaneously being like, how dare you forgive student loans and what is wealth? It's like, totally. This is a social safety net, right? Like, this is socialism. If we believe that the market just corrects itself, then we would let you fail and we just sort of deal with it, right? Like, you put your money in a bank that like made not great decisions with it, and you know, you're screwed. And that's just what happens to everyday people all the time. They like make a decision and the system sort of screws them over and they just got to eat it. But when you have $1 billion, apparently the cost to society is too big for you to eat it. And it's like, that actually is not the market. Like the fact that the government intervenes is not capitalism. This that's is what right. socialism looks like.
So I have some good old ignorant news for you all. And I've been on my high horse and high art and high cuisine, and this came on my timeline, and I was like, well, I guess on the podcast I have to go to hell and talk about just true ignorance and just go low. Samson, first of all, Fox has a subgenre news YouTube channel thing called Fox News, or excuse me, Fox Soul. and has some of the, it's Zeus and Fox Soul, I think are traps for our community. Has some of the worst program I've ever seen happen ever. And I've always seen little tidbits of homophobia or just really outdated ideas come out of those of that programming, but it never kind of like pierces the stratosphere. Like I never see it really take over the timeline. But lo and behold, it happened this week. Samson is on Fox Soul and was asked about pronouns. Samson is a Black gay comedian who is mostly known inside of the community, like one of those if you know, you know characters. But he's a cis gay Black man, but he was asked about pronouns because if you fall underneath this umbrella, we all got to know everything. I don't know why they even asked him. And then he tells this story that to me, when my mama nerves hear it, I'm like, oh, you lying. That did not happen. But he tells this story about a non-binary person who maybe presents as a, who seems masculine or cis assigned or whatever. And basically says, excuse me, sir. And then the person comes and says, I'm a ma'am. And Samson uses this story to say, well, if you're going to be gender non-binary or be trans, then you need to put some effort into it. And that putting some effort into it created such a just a firestorm of a conversation around gender identity, around what does it mean to be the things that you feel and who do you have to perform for? But then also, I guess in my spirit, it brought up, why are people asking people who have nothing to do with that identity, their opinion, if not just to create these controversies that are really steeped in transphobia, just so somebody can say something that is transphobic and so we can all be upset about it. That was what's most disappointing about it to me, was that somebody breadcrumbed somebody else into just proliferating transphobia for no reason, but so maybe it'll go viral or maybe they'll have a better moment. I know it's a complicated issue for some people, not to me anymore, but I think it's a really worthy issue inside of the black community to talk about gender and transness, because I think that transphobia and transness touches all Black people. And I feel like I've probably said this on this podcast 11 million times, that because Black people weren't necessarily afforded gender when we first came here in America, that we all have been swimming in a type of transness that I think listening to trans people talk about gender and identity will help all Black people, even if you identify with the if your sex and your gender, if you identify with what you were assigned with at birth, this conversation really does transcend and expand one's thoughts around identity. And it makes me sad that it's so othered and so simplified and made into such a joke when we do talk about it specifically inside of the Black community, because it's a really, really, really helpful framework to explore. And yeah, I wanted to bring this to the podcast. I wanted to have a little conversation, use this as an open door to have a conversation, or just to, you know, throw stones. I'm down for either option.
Here's what I'd say is that one of the things that was most troubling about Samson's comments, in addition to what you said, was that when challenged on it, Samson just dug his heels. Like, no critical reflection, no sort of deep engagement with people's criticisms initially. It was sort of, I said what I said, and sort of no understanding of his privilege as a cis man. Like, it just, I was not shocked by the initial comments because I've heard people say those things before. So I was disappointed, but not surprised. I was actually stunned by somebody who lives in public in some ways, to like not listen, not take feedback, not change comments. That was sad to me.
I will say, So first of all, I was like, is this really a show? Like, is this real? This does not seem real to me. What is going on here? And admittedly, I'd never heard of Samson before. And I was looking at him. I'm like, who is this dude? And like, so the whole thing, and I thought his comments were just so ludicrous. Like you, Miles, I was like, this didn't happen. The whole thing just seemed farcical to me. So I will be honest and say, I didn't even put credence into, like, he should have been thoughtful, he should have been reflective, he should say something different. It just seemed so unbelievable to me that I was like, who is this dude? Whatever, keep moving. I don't care, like, what he has to say. But I do think that I think we have to have serious conversations about the trans community within the Black community in ways that we have not. And I would love to hear, I guess, like, our leaders aren't talking, like, it's just sort of not really talked about or glossed over or violence, right? Like there is no constructive, maybe there's not wide stream constructive conversations about the trans community in the African-American community, in our churches, in our community centers, in other places where we have conversation. And so I wonder what it's going to take to change that.
What the hell is wrong with these people? I don't have anything that is substantive to say other than that, like, I mean, I can't believe this thing has 416,000 subscribers, this Fox Soul thing. And I think what's even more problematic to me is Sis who was like, well, I don't even know about the quick. Girl, go sit somewhere and sit down. What is wrong with you? It's just, I mean, I just feel like Black folk, you know, we want compassion and empathy and all these things from so many other people. And then we can't love ourselves enough to give it to one another within our communities. Like, I just don't understand it. Like, these aren't trans and queer folk. Like, it's not like we appeared yesterday. Come on now. Like, it's just wild to me. And I think when you go on, because I went on Samson's Twitter after you sent this, Miles, and it's like, now he's just getting so much content off of the silliness that he said, right? So it's also just playing into this whole, like, people needing to celebritize themselves as well. So it's just, it's sick, it's awful, ill, and we can do better.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
Hey there, Tommy Vitor, and if you're not subscribed to Pod Save America's YouTube channel, then you are leaving some sweet, sweet content on the table, and you don't want to do that. Here is a clip from my YouTube series, Liberal Tears, where Brian Tyler Cohn and I rank the worst moments in politics. The loser also has to do something terrible and embarrassing. In this case, you will have to hear it for yourself. A few weeks back, we talked about the phenomenon of MAGA rappers, Forgiato Blow, Vivek Ramaswamy, some of the best and the brightest in the rap game. I did win this time with 60% of the vote. So you're up in the punishment category. We were thinking it would be cool if, like Vivek, you could lose yourself to the music in the moment.
Lose yourself in the music the moment you own it. You better never let it go. Only your one shot, you not miss your chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime, yo.
Wow, Michigan.
Hit subscribe so you don't miss the fun, and make sure to check out the Pod Save America YouTube channel for more content.
This week, I saw this pop up and I was like, everyone pack your bags. So in Virginia last week, a Virginia judge ruled that frozen human embryos can legally be considered property or chattel. And he based this decision off of a 19th century law governing the treatment of enslaved people. What? What? I'm just the preliminary opinion, it was by a Fairfax County Circuit Court judge. And Fairfax County, mind you, is right outside of D.C. I'm not, this isn't like Lynchburg, Virginia. Like, this is in the DMV. So Richard Gardner delivered this opinion, and says this long-running dispute that's been happening between this divorced couple. But essentially, the ex-wife is suing her ex-husband to use the embryos that obviously his sperm are part of the embryos. And this Judge Gardner decides that the heart of this case, the facts in these case, really should be governed by the principle of goods and chattel, tying back to this 19th century law. I don't even know where to start. And he also said, you know, there's no prohibition on the sale of human embryos that may be valued and sold, and they must be considered as goods and chattel. Just like, that makes sense to him. This case is still sort of ongoing. He hasn't officially ruled, but what he has given is this premise based on this wild law that should be outdated. And why would any judge use this as precedent for deciding any case? And folks in Virginia that are part of the bar are in an uproar about it. But I'm at a loss for words on this one. I just don't understand why this judge would think. I mean, maybe the concept of an embryo being outside of someone's body was just so surprising and seemingly shocking to him that he, I don't know. There's no real clear legal standing or common sense standing for this.
It was just wild to me. I mean, you know, reproductive rights are a whole complicated issue. And, you know, I could see both sides in terms of the divorced couple, right? I want to use the embryos. I don't want you to use my embryos because you're not my wife no more, whatever. The thing is, in 2023, you couldn't find any other legal justification for how you wanted to rule but slavery. Okay, judge, are you elected? Are you appointed? It's time for somebody to rethink this thing. Because legal people are supposed to be some of our smartest folks sometimes. Supposed to be. And this dude reached way back in order to make his point. And like, that's just not politically expedient. It's just not smart. I don't have much else to say on that.
Wildly inappropriate. What's also interesting, to put it in a word, is that judge is still doing his job. That he is upholding he's actually doing the function of a judge. And I think that the fact that he did it so boldly and blatantly is getting us talking, making us outraging us, just, you know, as it should. But actually, he's upholding the exact system he's supposed to be upholding. And I think that these type of moments should fuel us to reexamine all things legal, all things justice system, because he's right. If that's where you're going to, that's where our legal system and our social justice system is undergirded by, is by slavery, by unfair and racist and white supremacist acts. So maybe, if I'm thinking about a silver lining, using this moment as a way for us to really be able to dig in and take all these legal point of views and take them back to their root and figure out what we can do to either totally transform them or just uproot some of them because they're obsolete. I'm optimistic. It's my birthday.
People often say, you know, happened so long ago, slavery's in the past, da, da, da. And it's like the foundation of the thing was just built on slavery. So unless you undo the foundation, it will live today. It might not live as loud as it lives. It might not live as totalizing as it lived before, but is it still present? And this is a good reminder that when we think about the penal code and the criminal justice system, it's like you actually have to uproot it at the core. It's the war on drugs is not enough, right? Bail is not enough. There's actually like a mindset and a sort of the minutiae of the law can live again unless we change it. And like, this is what I saw when I read your article, DR.
My news is about the Memphis Police Department and a 7-year period where they were trying to radically increase the number of police officers and change the complexion of the police force. And over those 7 years, they basically lowered their recruitment and training standards in order to meet these numerical quotas. There's a subtitle in the article that's called "More Recruits, More Problems," and that just about sums it up. Basically, Jim Strickland, who was the mayor of Memphis, made a commitment to radically increase the number of police on the force, which is what many cities across the country are currently doing. So just because this is happening in Memphis, it has probably also happened or happening in your neck of the woods. But he made a commitment to get to 2,300 officers. And over that 7-year period, basically the only way that they could do that was to relax their selection standards, relax their academic standards, relax their disciplinary standards, their fitness standards, their shooting standards. They basically threw out all of the rules that you needed to pass in order to become a police officer. This was all happening right after Mike Brown and a number of other police brutality and police murder cases, where public opinion about police was low, people weren't applying to be police officers. And so they did things like defer the college credit requirements. It used to be that in order to be a policeman, you had to have a certain number of college credits. They were like, yeah, as long as you promise to go to college at some point, you can be a police officer. You used to have to do things like pass the academy tests. And there were lots of young people, again, coming out with just high school diplomas who could not pass the academic tests that were required at the academy. And so they put them in study sessions where they basically gave them the test, gave them the answers, and then let them take the test again. They stopped interviewing people. Interviews, too time consuming. They stopped background checking the people. And again, too time consuming. And so you had people who had brutality accusations in the same county. And because nobody was background checking, you didn't realize that this dude was a bad apple, but you brought him into your relaxed standards police academy. And oh my gosh, he ended up being one of the 5 people who are charged with murdering Tyre Nichols. I wonder how that happened. Failures that used to lead to dismissals were now ignored. So things like cheating on tests, not passing your shooting test, sexual harassment of instructors at the academy. You run into issues with law enforcement while you're in the academy. Usually that would get you tossed out. None of that got you tossed out. All because they were trying to make this quota that the mayor, the former police chief, and oh yes, the current Black lady police chief, handed down. And so what you hear from a lot of the people who previously have worked at the academy is, wait a minute, like, this is not okay. These are people who were putting on the streets. We don't feel confident about them. And basically they were told, if you got a problem with it, you should put your paperwork in and leave this cushy Monday through Friday job and go hump it out on the streets, you know, on the weekends and at night with the dangerous criminals. And so there were lots of folks who they knew they were flagging during the academy that were likely to be problems, and they became problems. And so all of this potentially was foreseeable, but in the quest to put bodies in slots, you see this happening, not just in Memphis, as I said, but in lots of other places. And so, you know, there's not a lot of data that shows how police training works, but these officers, many of the officers who spoke out about this spoke on the condition of anonymity, because many of them are still working at the police department. And, you know, they talk about the responsibility of training police officers and how all of that went out the window in this effort to meet their recruitment numbers. So I thought this was an interesting and important piece of the Tyre Nichols story that we had not yet heard. And as I said, I think it's happening. There are lots of police departments who, because of the rising crime and people wanting to be tough on crime, you're seeing a lot of police departments or municipalities allocate more money for more police. But there's not a whole bunch of people sitting out on Great Policeman Island waiting for us to just find them. And we have to invest in high standards around recruitment, selection, training. I mean, this is the whole teacher thing, right? That's how I know this human capital problem, but it's a police problem as well. And I thought you all might want to talk about it on the pod today.
That is ridiculous. The fact...
You say what now?
You know me, I come straight from the gut with it. I'm like, they just put the standards on the standards on Fox Soul in order to make sure we got to keep this thing racist. We got to keep this thing violent, and we got to keep it going. And whatever we have to do, we will continue to do it, and we'll turn a blind eye to this, and we'll turn our head to this in order to make sure that it's still violent. It's truly disgusting. And again, I feel like I say this often here too, is it always perplexes me how, it probably doesn't perplex me, but it probably still stuns me. No, nonetheless, just how cannibalistic it is. It's like, this is not good for anybody. Of course, Black people are going to be harmed because of these choices, but also this is not good for anybody in that community. These low standards. So it always stuns me how white supremacy will create things that eats its own as long as you're devoured too. It's not, oh, let us survive and be good and we're gonna eat you all. It's like, oh no, we'll eat our own as long as we get to chew on your bones too. Just a horrible set of standards. But thank you for bringing it to the podcast, Kaya, because you know I needed that fire. I'm upset.
I'm just thinking about. Just because I've worked, I mean, and Dereka, I'm sure you know a lot more than I do, but I just worked a tad on public schools in Memphis. And I'm also just thinking about if young people graduating or on the verge of not graduating from high school, and I think Latino kids in Memphis have the lowest graduation rates, if they were given as many times as these people to achieve something, I just wonder what better outcomes we would have. I'm just thinking, like, you're getting your hand held to get through these things, to pass these tests, to not pass these tests, maybe cheat on these tests, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just, why couldn't this effort and care and diligence be put towards where it should be put towards?
One of the things that I'm heartened by is that when people know this, they think it's wrong across party. We've done a lot of polling campaigns here. And when people realize these details, they are like, unacceptable, wild, shouldn't be the case, da da da. The problem is that they just don't know. So like when we poll, when the police lie to people across party, people are like, that's bad. Most of the things that you've heard in criminal justice reform or harm reduction, da da da, when we poll people across party, they're actually on our side. But people's impression of the police is actually just so holistically positive that we lose when we sort of try and address the institution as a whole. But I'm telling you, if we poll people right now and we're like, do you think there should be no entrance requirements, no interviews, no... People across party, across age would be like, this is actually unacceptable. And this to me, I read this guy and was like, wow, what an incredible organizing moment to like force this conversation and to create an entrance for people who otherwise are like, the police do all these great things and da da da. In the same way that like people would be appalled if nurses all of a sudden never got interviewed or like never got, like you'd be like, that's really unacceptable. Or like even if teachers, you know, there are some states that are really relaxing standards, but the idea that there'd be none. People like, I would never send my kid to a school where like you just hired any old
high school graduate, no background check, and you didn't interview them. But I mean, that would be horrific for teachers, but we are putting guns in these people's hands. Like, we are, like, this is, I mean.
Right.
Yeah, and if people knew, I am positive, all the testing that we've done, I mean, all the polling that we've done would confirm it. Piggybacking off this, my article is about, I think before I became an activist and understood the system writ large, I actually did not know how much the public safety conversation guided everything. I think when I was a teacher, I thought education was a thing. Because I remember, Kai, and you know this because you were actually, you know, ran a whole school system. I remember the first time that I actually understood that people choose homes based on schools. Like, I know I'd heard it before, but I didn't know it was like a real, that people like legitimately moved to neighborhoods because of schools. And I'm like, oh man, that means that's like the quality of the people in my building actually helped shape the neighbor. I like didn't, it was something I saw in movies. I didn't know it was like a real thing until I got older. And I was like, you really moved your whole house because of the kindergarten program, which is really four teachers and a good principal. You know what I mean? Like, this is really just good people. And I didn't know how much the public safety conversation shapes almost everything else that's not education. So this article is about how in a conversation about public safety, when people are being elected to office who are progressive or don't see the police as the only, they might not even be progressive, but don't see the police as the best option for public safety, how there's a attack on local control. So we talked about Jackson. We talked about the attempt of the state to like take over Jackson. We talked about that before. But what I didn't know until I saw this, I didn't realize that in St. Louis City, there is an effort, or in Missouri, there's an effort to take back the police department from local control in St. Louis City and have it run by the state. Mind you, the police in St. Louis City have been independent for almost a decade, definitely were for the protests, and I lived through that. And it was a, you know, not great mayor then, and a certainly super racist police department that were out to get us. And now that Tashara is the mayor, Black woman, progressive, you know, some people don't like everything she's done, but she is by far the most progressive mayor they've had in a long time. And you see now these renewed calls to take it back, to like take local control away from the police department. And I think that this will be the thing that, like, again, if I didn't have to prep it for the podcast, I wouldn't know at all. But this is what I don't think is leading in the public conversation. And I wanted to bring it here.
I have some particular feelings about this because in the place where I live, Washington, D.C., our local government tried to revise our criminal code, which was over 100 years old and was outdated. And the city council passed it. The mayor wasn't super excited about it, but whatever, like, this is the way democracy works. And because what people don't understand is that DC is still a colony, we don't get to make our own rules without congressional approval. And so the crime hawks in Congress didn't like the revision of our code. First of all, they didn't understand the revision of our code. They just thought it was going soft on crime, when in fact, if you understand the nuances, it was not going soft on crime. And so led by the congressional Republicans, they set out to disapprove the criminal code changes. And then our president, who has stood up for home rule for DC, et cetera, who talks about democracy and all of that jazz, when he had the opportunity, decided that it was more important to protect his right flank by siding with these congressional Republicans, oh, and a bunch of Democrats as well, to say, we don't like DC's criminal code because we're tougher on crime. And so they vetoed it. They overrode local democracy. And, you know, Republicans are super hypocritical because all they want to talk about is states' rights and local rights and all of that jazz. And we made some decisions ourselves about how we want to be governed here in Washington, where we pay, y'all that got me started, honey, where we pay more taxes per capita than any other state in the union. And these folks who have nothing to do with our community get to decide what, how, or how we will and won't govern ourselves. It is absolutely reprehensible. Most United States citizens have no idea that anytime the federal government shuts down, the DC government technically has to shut down as well. Our schools shut down, all kinds of things because of the way we're tethered to the federal government. And in this case, because the country is, because the Democrats want to show that they are tough on crime, they completely rode roughshod over our democratic rights to govern ourselves. It is absolutely ridiculous. Okay, I'm done now.
I mean, all I can do is applaud that. what kind of
rant? I got more.
I wouldn't even insult what you just said with a follow up. This has been like an educational moment for me. Of course, I'm outraged, but I think Auntie Kaya really just, you know, guns a blazing.
I second that as a DC native.
I mean, you said it. We saw it in Jackson with them creating a special zone absolutely. For the white other, people mm-hmm. with a whole different police force and all of this jazz. Why? Because of crime. Like this whole crime allowing us to throw out all of the rules and regulations is absolutely reprehensible.
And it's just politicization, right? Like it's wild to me. When I was at the State Department, one of my jobs was basically a law advisor. I mean, I had no business doing this, but I'd go to other countries and help them reform old and outdated criminal procedure codes, evidence codes. And so it's wild that that can happen far, 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 far away. But the upgrades that we need here in the place that I was raised, no, still going off of 100-year-old rules. So I think to give y'all more added perspective to set you off.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
Hey there, Tommy Vitor. And if you're not subscribed to Pod Save America's YouTube channel, then you are leaving some sweet, sweet content on the table. And you don't want to do that. Here is a clip from my YouTube series, Liberal Tears, where Brian Tyler Cohen and I rank the worst moments in politics. The loser also has to do something terrible and embarrassing in this case. You will have to hear it for yourself. A few weeks back, we talked about the phenomenon of MAGA rappers. Forgiato Blow, Vivek Ramaswamy.
There's
some of the best and the brightest in the rap game. I did win this time with 60% of the vote. So you're up in the punishment category. We were thinking it would be cool if, like Vivek, you could lose yourself to the music in the moment.
Lose yourself in the music the moment you own it. You better never let it go. Only your one shot, do not miss your chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime, yo.
Wow, none of you grew up in Michigan.
Hit subscribe so you don't miss the fun and make sure to check out the Pod Save America YouTube channel for more content.
This week, we welcome author and award-winning reporter Chip Jones to talk about his new book, The Oregon Thieves, the shocking story of the first heart transplant in the segregated South. After a healthy Black factory worker had a skull fracture in the 1960s, his family was shocked to find that his heart was transplanted into the body of a white man without his knowledge or consent. Y'all, I learned so much. It was wild. You gotta read it to believe it, listen to the interview to believe it. What a world. Here we go. Chip Jones, thanks so much for being with us today on Pod Save the People.
Thank you, DeRay. It really is an honor and a pleasure.
So what's wild is I had seen a story about Bruce Tuckin, the first heart transplant, on Twitter, actually. And I read an article and I was like, okay, this feels wild. And then it was like, oh, this is a story included in your book. And I sent a text to our producer. And I was like, can you find him? Like, is he doing interviews? Like, is he around? Is he doing interviews? He's talking. And then, and you are doing interviews and you're here. So honored to be here. I will tell you, I read the book and I was like, oh, this might be just like a longer accounting of the article. And then I'm like, oh my goodness, there's so much stuff in here that I like literally never knew, never thought about. So let's start at the beginning though.
Sure.
How did you get to this story about the first successful heart transplant? Did you always care about hearts? Did you care about medical school? I don't know. How did you get here?
Oh, well, Right. Basically, I'm a former investigative reporter. I spent a lot of time like researching the tobacco industry in the 90s. And I'm down here in the kind of heart of darkness in Richmond, Virginia, with tobacco. And I've written a few other books about the Marines because I came from a Marine family. And I was working a second career at a medical academy here in Richmond and learning a lot about medicine. And one day, actually, the story of my book started as a public relations problem. because and I just being real about it. But I figured out the best way to boil this down when I talk to audience, it's like, well, how did you hear about this? Well, like a lot of things in life, it's sort of, you know, from the side door or whatever. I was a colleague of mine at this academy that represents a lot of different kinds of doctors in the region down here in Richmond, Virginia. He's saying, you know, the older doctors, and basically, frankly, it was all older white doctors, were like, they really wanted, they're clamoring to have an event for this, to honor the 50-year anniversary of this heart transplant. And I'm like, okay, I didn't know anything about it. But this guy said to me, but there's a problem. I said, what's the problem? And he kind of told me the backstory. He's like, well, the heart came from an African-American factory worker in Richmond, Virginia. And it actually led to a lawsuit 4 years later. And I go, oh, really? Yeah. And oh, yeah. Guess who represented the family? And he said, I said, who? He said, Doug Wilder. And, oh, Governor Doug Wilder, you know, first black governor in Virginia history. And I kind of, as a reporter in Richmond, I've been around his administration stuff. So I'm like, well, that's kind of interesting. And so I'm going, well, what's the public relations problem for our society? He says, well, you know, these older doctors, they want to venerate this event. But if it's an open event and a reporter asks about what happened, it's got to be some hard questions. So since I worked at this medical society, I kind of made it my hobby just to go dig into it. And then very quickly, I heard another thing, DeRay, about the story that blew my mind, which I was a teenager when this happened. I lived around D.C. then. And there's a guy named Christian Barnard who was very famous back in the day, 67, 68. And he was the South African heart surgeon. And he was part of this whole story because he had taken the technology, the medical technology from Richmond and actually gone back to, you know, South Africa, apartheid South Africa, and applied the Richmond surgeon's techniques to sort of win this huge race. Because it was kind of like, you know, and I started thinking about it kind of as a book. It was kind of like a race to the moon, but it was a heart transplant race. So that's how it started. I mean, I just, first of all, you know, my colleague had to keep away the older doctors who wanted to like hold this event. Like, this is the greatest thing since the Civil War, you know? And like, no, we're not going to do that because there's a whole range of kinds of physicians in the society. And some of them are liberal, some of them are conservative. But the one thing, you know, that the society itself shouldn't do would be like just put out some propaganda for these guys. So they put that to the side. I made it my own project. Like on Friday afternoons, I go down to the Medical College of Virginia. It's now called Virginia Commonwealth University, VCU, and started looking through the archives. I basically got a master's level degree in medical education over a whole year. And that's how it all started until I finally interviewed Mr. Wilder, Governor Wilder. He kind of didn't want to talk about it. And I finally had an interview with him. And that's in 2017. And that's kind of where it took off for me developing it as a book.
How'd you finally get him to say yes?
You know, DeRay, I basically, this whole story is me, the lowly reporter, basically. I'm not trying to put myself on a pedestal, but just sort of saying, look, I'm just trying to keep it real, Governor Wilder. And I wrote him a letter through a third party intermediary, very, very nice guy at a law school who passed it along. And I said, basically, as I recall it, and I'm just trying to remember a few years ago, but it was like, Governor Wilder, this man's story has never really been properly told. And that's all I want to do. And so from the very beginning, my initial goal was just to tell the story of this forgotten man named Bruce Tucker. it was basically forgotten history.
Got it. So can you give, I've had the luxury of reading the book, and there's so much more in the book outside of just this one story. But can you tell us about Bruce Tucker?
Yes. Well, he was a guy who grew up in rural Virginia, outside of Petersburg, which is, for listeners never been to Virginia, it's about 30 minutes south of the state capital of Richmond. Grew up, a hard, I think, farming life, segregated schools in the 50s. And he followed his brother to Richmond. His brother had polio, actually, William, and he was a very successful small businessman. William Tucker started a shoe repair business. And so Bruce Tucker followed him up into Richmond in the mid-50s and got a job at a factory. It was actually an egg processing plant, of all things. You learn a lot about history when you just start digging. It's like, who knew? Shoe repair shops, egg processing. A lot of this stuff is kind of nerdy, but as a researcher, you really get into the nerdy stuff too. But I learned that he was, a guy who lived by himself. He was divorced, but he had a son living back on the farm whose name is Abraham, and he was sending child support payments back home to his son and his grandmother. And then one day after work on May 24th, 1968, he was sitting around with some guys, just having a drink. I don't know exactly. I think it was just passing a wine bottle around or something. And he fell off a very low wall and he hit his head and had a very serious head injury. His skull was basically fractured, but he was rushed to a nearby hospital, which was Medical College of Virginia. It's a big teaching hospital in Richmond. And so he's rushed in. And just to jump ahead on the story, okay, people can read the rest. But what really, first of all, shocked me and then ultimately just saddened me was that less than 24 hours, his heart was gone. And the official idea and the official autopsy report that I found said, he died of a head injury. Well, no, he died when the heart surgeons pulled the plug on the respirator and let him die. So the story begins, the book begins, if you've read it, begins with a frantic phone call from his brother, William, who's saying, Mr. Wilder, then Doug Wilder was a very, young, maybe about your age now, the late 30s. I think of anyone in their 40s, really, really young, by the way. my son's about your age, I think. And so he said, I need help. And Wilder was at first kind of like you, kind of like anybody who hears this story, like, no way. How did this, what happened? They stole his heart or they took his heart. We can talk about words and their meanings if you want to, Dad, because this was part of my whole evolution as a writer and kind of absorbing the story. Like, well, what was it? Was it a theft? Was it an accident or was it something else? Was it a murder? And, so Wilder took the case and it took 4 years till it went to trial. It was the first civil lawsuit over heart transplants in the United States. No one had ever challenged an institution. And it actually slowed down transplants around the country at the time because a lot of the big hospitals, I'm sure, like Johns Hopkins in Baltimore or Columbia or out in LA, they slowed down everything because the whole country, at least the medical transplant community, was looking to see how this jury would rule. And if you read the book, you see how the ruling went, and it did not go well for the Tucker family. And the amazing thing, Duray, is right now that there's still a backstory to it that's still unfolding. And I don't know how it's going to resolve, but the university has apologized. I saw you did a recent podcast about apologies, and I started thinking about apologies, the nature of apologies. They apologized recently, and they said they were going to do some things, but that still, remains to be seen. So that's kind of it in a nutshell in terms of the issues, but I can stop and let you ask me what's on your mind.
So one of the things that I didn't know at all was, you know, in the early chapters, when you talk about just the history of stealing bodies, I like yep. didn't know any of that. I was like, you know, I'm like reading and I'm like, oh, this is going to be a deep dive on Bruce Tucker. Da-da. And then I'm like, oh my goodness, they're stealing bodies from Black cemeteries and medical residents are being asked to go and dig up bodies. People are, you know, standing outside of the doctor's place ready to kill them. You know, how did you find that out? Like this, the idea that Bruce Tucker, and there's another thing that I was like, oh my God, was that they stole the Black person's kidneys in South Africa. It was South Africa, right?
Yeah, well, they took Tucker's kidneys too when they took his heart. So they took his, they didn't just take his heart, just for good measure, they took his kidneys too.
And when
with no prior consent, this is the important thing. There's nobody in his family knew about it.
The idea though that he wasn't even the first person that they stole from, that like, because the South African story happened first, right?
Yeah. And there were other things happening. You know, your response, DeRay, and I'm glad to hear that, because that was my response when I first started reading the archives of the hospital. Basically, I could not believe that essentially what I learned was that medical research, medical schools in America were all founded on grave robbing. It done Harvard in the late 1700s, Columbia, Penn, they were doing, this was having to have bodies for the anatomy class was the only thing that they did outside of book learnings. So they had incorporated this from Europe. This happened in England and in France. My response was the same as yours, total horror and shock. And the thing about it, DeRay, that blew my mind was it stopped in Harvard and Columbia and other places before the Civil War, but like so many things in the South, it kept going during the Jim Crow era and into the 20th century. And my old man was born in 1916, and the guy who was the keeper of the grave robbing, Chris Baker, he lived in the medical school building, and he was known as a body man. And they had other people like this at different universities. They were like, it was it was part of Jim Crow medical schools. You had this guy who was paid as a janitor, but he was really like a professor because he knew as much about surgery as a lot of the medical professors did. And Chris Baker was sort of venerated and glorified up until around World War II. And this was the thing, like for me, like, hey, I was
He's called right old Chris in the book, right? Or like,
yeah, old Chris, yeah.
Old Chris, yeah.
He was, you know, sort of like this figure of, you know, that kind of Jim Crow, old South kind of stuff where like, oh, he was a great guy and he taught us so much, you know, kind of like Gone with the Wind or something, but digging up bodies. But the fact is that in the U.S., this is why I set it up in the book. I was trying to show what could have led to someone stealing a man's heart, especially a Black man's heart. What could have led to this? And the more I got into it, I felt like the reader needed to understand this is the fundamentals of American medical education. And I bring you up to date at the end when they found a whole set of bodies, skeletons, in 1994. And those skeletons are still in the very foundation of VCU medical school, because the university didn't want to stop a construction project, and they covered it up. That's the last chapter of my book. It's called Down in the Well, and they're still dealing with it. So
I'm like, what even else to say? The one of the other stories that like was small, but that Black people had actually tried to sue or like tried to pass a law or something to stop the grave robbery and were unsuccessful in it. But it was like, it was cool to see people were trying to fight back and like
the anatomy rights. Yeah. There were anatomy rights in New York City, in Philadelphia, Boston. And I thought that was good too. And there was a big pushback. And in Richmond, there was a crusading editor named John Mitchell, who somebody should make a movie about too. And he was a tough son of a gun who put out the Richmond, his magazine was in Richmond. I think it was called The Mercury, but I might have that wrong. But he was a tough summoner gun who actually strapped on six guns and went down to Danville, Virginia to write stories about lynching. So John Mitchell, in his newspaper, called this out as late as the 1890s, because Black people in Richmond were tired of it, even during Jim Crow, and were willing to speak up. And they would take prisoners from the Virginia State Pen about a mile away and take them over and take out their organs. So, but all around the country, there was a whole set of, they call them anatomy riots, dating back into I think the 1840s or, long ago, because either freed Blacks and sometimes poorer whites would see that that their graveyards were being plundered. And one thing I learned, as a white person who grew up in privilege and grew up around churches that had graveyards, is that's why there was a whole system of burying bodies closer to the doors of the church and of protecting the graveyards, because the working class people and often the people of color couldn't afford the protection. And once some people in New York or Philly, sometimes it was kids looking through the windows of the medical school, they go back, you know what they're doing in there? And that it led to riots. And different states, New York passed some laws and it took a long, they passed a law in Richmond and in Virginia, but it was never enforced. Typical Jim Crow stuff that they just turned the other way until the practice stopped. I guess, just sort of fizzled out because other people had died. They did pass a law to regulate it, and it finally did settle down. But the fact it took to the 20th century, I think it's the attitudes, continued into the modern times about people of color, and I called the issue, they called it social death, or being socially dead. If you had liquor on your breath as a Black man, especially, or a Black woman, into a big urban hospital, whether it was Chicago, New York, Philly, Richmond, you were the invisible man.
There was one part of the book that there was a question I didn't know the answer to.
Sure.
As you talk about the penny death insurance,
mm-hmm.
Can you explain that to me? I didn't understand it.
Well, the reason I brought that in was because the idea of having a proper burial was in the 1880s, 1890s, because people were afraid, especially working class people or poorer people, were afraid of having their bodies snatched. The insurance industry started to prosper because people would pay a little bit. I guess you call it penny insurance, but they would pay a little bit so that they could protect their loved one and actually have a proper burial. And never knew. So many things in America are so weird and intermeshed, but the whole insurance industry, the whole medical industry, medical research, drawing on people's fears, because they were justifiable fears too. And suspicions that go on today, they've gone on through COVID. I've done so many interviews around the country where people, often Black readers or commentators, will say, I'm seeing people not really feeling the love about getting the COVID shot. And it dates back to this kind of suspicion. And the only good thing one of the good things I can say about the use of the book, it's part of a educational effort at Virginia Commonwealth in history and medicine. They've used it. And mm-hmm. And other universities, like Politico had a good story recently where they started with my book, and but it was out of Johns Hopkins, and they talked about a real reframing of the discussion at medical schools about historical trauma and talking about it in real ways and trying to understand all of the emotional and psychological baggage that not only Black patients, but Black physicians might have to deal with. So my initial, effort has always been to tell the Bruce Tucker story. And if there's anything redemptive about it, it is that hopefully it will help enlighten a lot of people and lead to, more equal treatment there'll never be perfect treatment of people, I don't think, just because human nature isn't perfect, but, you know, trying to do better.
It also reminds me, you know, we talk about this idea that everything's about race and people are like, you're being dramatic. And you're like, nope, it actually.
No. If anything, we understate it. And people don't want to talk about it. In Virginia now, the governor doesn't want it. He doesn't want these kinds of things in the classroom. And yeah.
Now, how has it been since the book came out? Are there, you know, I can only imagine, like me, people are shocked. Have there been any interesting responses to it?
You know, yes, there have been a lot of interesting responses. And, you know, I'll just go right to the ones that have been more heartening to me is when I've had readers who are Black of all ages and people who are friends, like a friend of mine I can think of from the YMCA who told me that he grew up in rural Virginia around where the Loving case took place in Caroline County. He said, I always wondered, Chip, why my parents would never go down to MCV. And I learned that from your book. And also other readers, I think, you know, who said that it helped them to just better understand either their own fears or other people's fears of healthcare. And in general, I think, the interesting thing to me is if I speak to groups, where I speak to them, if I speak to them in the city, one set of responses, and then if I speak to more white conservative readers, frankly, outside of town, it's a whole different thing. And it's like, you know, well, why are you telling the story? You know, like I'm over-dramatizing it. And I'm saying, no. And as a matter of, you know, that's been the educational process for me. If any, as a reporter, you always sort of try to keep it kind of even and on even keel. But, you know, I mean, I guess the learning from other people, you know, and learning what I didn't know continues. And the thing I always say that, you know, when I started out, it was like I had this story in my head about the heart transplant race and everything. But it really went from my head to my heart, because it really is all about a real wrong and the need to feel empathy. And so, you know, the other thing, as I was writing it here in town, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests were happening. The monuments were coming down. So I felt like, you know, kind of like writing a novel about the Civil War during the Civil War, because it was like there was just I knew it was important, I guess is what I'm saying. And that I hoped I could do an adequate job of it.
And what happened to William Tucker?
So William Tucker, well, he lived for a number of years. I don't really know when he passed away, but Governor Wilder told me he was just really bitter that, you know, the jury's judgment against the family kind of reinforced his sense of racial prejudice. But his son Abraham is still alive, and that's one of he's in his mid-60s, and you'll see in the book that he didn't want to talk to me, which I didn't blame him, and I was basically trying not to like re-traumatize him. But since then, he's told me he actually had a phone call with me not that long ago where it helped him on some level to come to terms with what happened in the past. But back to this idea of an apology, that the university issued an apology, but I'm hearing from some of his relatives that they're not so sure about that. So the book is still open.
And can you contextualize why the Bruce Tucker case matters in the world of medicine?
Well, it matters, first of all, because, you know, if you go back to Hippocrates, to do no wrong, that's all that was done to him. I mean, his life was forgotten and thrown away. But I think in the world of medicine right now, it matters because there needs to be a awareness and sensitivity to people's real experiences and their shared pain of not receiving equal and first-class care. So it matters, and I've been told by physicians who are younger now that they're glad that this is one of the many stories, and there's, you know, many, many other stories about it from, you know, Henrietta Lacks and Tuskegee syphilis experience. So it's part, it fits on that continuum of stories that shouldn't be forgotten. And I always say also the importance of ethics and morality, because you could be in any situation and you could be put in a position where, well, you're going to win something. You're going to win a heart transplant race, but at what price? And I think everything that's happened in the U.S. in the past few years, you know, and especially the lack of compassion to society, it's important. It's important that the healthcare system kind of try to stay on or get on the right side of history.
And this was the first heart transplant in the South.
In the segregated below the Mason-Dixon line. It was the 9th in the U.S. And it was the 16th in the world. But it was part of a whole sort of train of transplants that happened in 1968.
Got it.
Yep.
Okay. There are two questions I ask everybody. The first is, what do you say to people whose hope is challenged in moments like this? People who have read your book, read mine, listened to podcasts, voted, testified, stood in the street, and they're like, the world's not getting better in the way I want it to. What do you say to people whose hope is challenged?
Wow. I think the first thing I would say is to always, you know, go to the light, you know, go to the people that are with you and trying to build you up in hope. And I feel that way about this book because I didn't do it by myself. I did it because of a lot of different folks around town and around the U.S. who helped me out. So I think hope is something that is not individualistic. I think it, for me personally, it's kind of a group experience. I think that it's easy to get disillusioned. And so I think all of us have to find, you know, what really is our moral core, or if we have a, you know, higher power or believe in God, what's that? But what's that to me in terms of hoping for everybody, you know, not just like hoping you win the lottery. So.
And then the second is, what's a piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that stuck with you?
Piece of advice. I would say to trust my intuition. And that came from my old man who was in like three wars and unfortunately saw a lot of his friends die at places like Tarawa and Saipan, the World War II in the Pacific. And he had a lot of interesting experiences on the front lines. So I always, even though I didn't go in the military myself, my dad's belief in intuition and dreams, because I think dreams are a way that are a gift that ties you into, you know, what you're really about and what you should be doing if you listen closely enough.
Boom. Well, everybody, got to read this book. You'll learn a ton. Thank you so much for coming. We consider you a friend of the pod. How do people stay in touch with you? Is it Twitter? Is it Facebook? Is it a website?
I have chipjonesbooks.com. Is a website. I am on Instagram, but probably my website is the best. But it's just Chip Jones Books on Instagram too.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out and make sure you rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Evan Sutton. Executive produced by me. And special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.